30 years, Wichita, Kansas, suffers at the hands of a faceless and brutal killer who binds, suffocates, and strangles his victims.
Both of our parents slaughtered right there on the ground, you know? Tied up like pigs, man.
But in 2005, a suspect is arrested, and seven families hope they'll finally get justice for their loved ones.
He said, "How many more people do I have to kill before I get my name in the paper?"
But the man on the stand is not what they'd expected.
And he was a decent, nice-looking, tall man.
This is the man accused of being the notorious serial killer who called himself BTK for bind, torture, and kill. January the 15th, 1974, in Wichita, Kansas. 14-year-old Danny Otero walks home from school with his 13-year-old sister, Carmen. They live with their parents, Julie and Joseph, older brother Charlie, and younger brother and sister Joey and Josephine.
My sister and I were coming home from school. We just moved to the area. We'd only been there maybe a month. She was ahead of me. She went in first, I went right behind her. She went on into the hallway, through the kitchen, into the hallway, and took a right. I stopped in the kitchen. I believe I was opening the fridge. I heard her screaming. I said, "Danny, Danny, something's wrong." And she goes, "It's Mom and Dad." I saw my dad's body laying in the doorway inside the bedroom. He had a belt around his neck. And then I looked over to my right, and I realized my mom was there too, and I said, "Oh no, man, it was this bad." Biddy says, "She's got a rope around her neck." I said, "Get it off, do whatever you get it off." I jumped back down on my dad, and I looked in his eyes, and his eyes were rolled back. I was trying to do something. It didn't take more than 5 seconds to realize he was dead. You know, both of our parents slaughtered right there on the ground, you know? Tied up like pigs, man. Brutally murdered.
Danny tries to phone for help, but the line is dead. Afraid someone's still in the house, he drags his sister outside and runs to a neighbor's to call police. There's still no sign of Joey and Josephine.
So they take us downtown, and we're in the police station, and we're starting to wonder, where the hell is Joey and Josie, you know? You know, how are we gonna tell Joey and Josie Mom and Dad are dead? And then finally, a priest comes in the room. And I almost knew what he was gonna say.
Police find 9-year-old Joey in another bedroom, suffocated. They find his 11-year-old sister, Josephine, in the basement. She had been hung from pipes. Semen was found on the floor beside her. It was a case that horrified Wichita. Police scour the Otero home, but find very little to go on. In 1974, DNA analysis is still in its infancy, but the semen found near Josephine's body is recovered and preserved. Then 9 months later, a Wichita newspaper is sent a chilling letter that claims responsibility for the Otero killings and describes the murder scene in vivid detail. And what's written next is terrifying.
"When this monster entered my brain, I will never know, but it's here to stay."
The letter suggests This is just the beginning.
He has already chosen his next victim or victims. I don't know who they are yet. Good luck hunting. The code words for me will be bind them, torture them, kill them. BTK. They will be on the next victim.
I think that's an interesting thing.
This one piece will make 52 layers.
Watch on mobile devices or the big screen. All for free. No subscription required.
The police decide to keep quiet about the letter, eager to prevent any copycat incidents. But then, all goes quiet. It will be 3 years before the killer would resurface. March 17th, 1977. 6-year-old Steve Relford is on his way home to his brother and sister, and his mother, Shirley Vianne.
My mom sent me to the store to get a can of soup because she was sick. And on my way back, this guy stopped me. Showed me a picture of this woman and this boy and asked me, did I know who it was? I said, no, sir, I don't. So I went on to my house and he went to my neighbor's house.
But the man is watching where Steve goes. He knows the young boy's mother must be at home.
About 15 minutes later, he comes knocking on my door. I opened the door. He asked, is your parents home? I said, my mom, she's sick in bed. And he proceeded to come on in.
The man pulls the blinds and pulls out a gun.
About that time, my mom came to the door, and mom said, do what he says.
Stay behind me, sweetie. Don't.
Well, he told my mom to put blankets and toys in the bathroom. He tied one door shut from under the sink and then closed the door and pushed the bed up against the other door.
Steve and his brother and sister are all trapped in the bathroom.
I stood on the bathtub and looked over the door. There was like a crack in the top of the door where I could see. And I wish I hadn't.
Steve watches as the man ties his mother's hands and feet. Places a bag over her head, a cord around her neck, and suffocates and strangles her.
No! No!
The killer would later write that he'd intended to murder the children too, just like the Oteros. But the telephone ringing made him lose his nerve and leave. By the time Steve gets out of the bathroom, it's too late.
I knew my mom was dead. I didn't talk for like 2 years afterward. I miss her very much.
Steve would have to wait almost 3 decades, not knowing who was responsible for killing his mother. 8 months later, there's another killing. 25-year-old Nancy Fox is found in her home, strangled with a belt. Soon afterwards, the Wichita Eagle receives a poem in the post that mentions both Shirley Vianne and Nancy Fox.
Shirley Locks, Shirley Locks, wilt thou be mine?
The newspaper doesn't publish the poem straight away, so the killer writes to local TV station, Cake TV.
BTK was one of those kind of guys who really wanted the publicity. And he said, how many more people do I have to kill before I get my name in the paper? When you read something like that, then you know you really have a serial killer right in your midst.
The letter claims responsibility for the killing of Shirley Vianne and Nancy Fox. He then suggests he He should have a nickname.
How about some name for me? It's time. I like the following. The BTK Strangler? Wichita Strangler?
Up to this point, the people of Wichita had been kept in the dark. But now police announced there's a serial killer on the loose who calls himself BTK, and he's threatened to strike again. For the people of Wichita, it's petrifying.
Stores sold out of locks. Gun sales went up. People were scared. If you used to leave your front door open, you didn't leave your front door open anymore. Young women in this community were terrified.
In the meantime, the police are still no closer to catching the killer.
They were trying to connect all these killings, that maybe the women worked for the same place he worked for, or that there was some connection. There wasn't.
The trail goes cold again. BTK's correspondence with the police and media stops. It's 8 years before he strikes again. In 1985, the body of 53-year-old Marina Hedge is found dumped in a ditch at the side of the road. A year later, 28-year-old mother of two, Vicky Wegerle, is strangled with a pair of nylon stockings in her own home. And in 1991, 62-year-old Dolores Davis's body is found under a bridge with knotted pantyhose and a freakish mask by her side. All of the victims have been strangled, but the police don't connect them to the BTK killer. And unlike before, he didn't write to claim responsibility. He'll remain silent for another 13 years.
Our conversations up here would be, where do you think this guy is? Maybe he died. Maybe somebody committed him. Maybe he's just still walking around out there.
But it would not stay quiet forever. In 2004, the Wichita Eagle publishes a story commemorating 30 years since the Otero killings and discussing a new book on the notorious BTK. The killer sees this, and he just can't resist getting back in touch. He sends a letter to the paper claiming responsibility for the unsolved murder of Vicky Wegerle 18 years earlier. Inside is a copy of her driving license and pictures of the crime scene. The return address is for one Bill Thomas Kilman. BTK is back. Suddenly, correspondence from BTK is cropping up everywhere, and it's even more bizarre than before.
He would put them into cereal boxes, as in serial killer. He would dress a doll up in there to resemble the victim, and he would put little trophies that he might have collected.
Then, in January 2005, police get a possible break. They find one package containing a note with a very naive question.
If I send you a disc, be honest with me, will you be able to trace it back to me?
The police can't quite believe it. They reply to BTK, as they had done many times before, by posting an advert in the newspaper. Just maybe he'll fall for it.
They said, "It'll be okay, Rex." That was what he had wanted us to say. So in other words, sure, send the disc, no problem, we won't be able to tell you who you are.
Incredibly, on February the 16th, a local TV station receives a floppy disc in the post. Police quickly get to work analyzing it.
Inside there are the codes showing the name of the person who had copied materials to that disc, the location where he had been when he had done it.
The name they find is Dennis. The location, the Christ Lutheran Church in Wichita. An internet search quickly determines that a Dennis Rader is president of the church council.
And up he pops, and there's his picture on this church website.
The man identified, Dennis Rader, lives with his wife and two children in a normal house on this normal street in Park City, just north of Wichita. He works as a compliance officer for the local council.
The dogs are somewhat territorial as well as vicious, and we've been trying to round them up and corral them as best we can.
If a dog was running loose, then he would cite the owner. If somebody was letting the grass grow too high or putting trash on their yard, he would go by and tell them they had to clean it up.
He's known for being quite particular, a stickler for the rules, a law-abiding, devout Christian who's lived in and around Wichita almost his whole life. Born in 1945, he'd had an apparently happy childhood. In his 20s, he joined the Air Force and spent 4 years traveling the world before returning to live in Park City, where he met his wife. Now his two children are in their teens. He's president of the church council, and he's a Cub Scout leader. He seems like the model citizen. But police are confident he's their man. Now to prove it, they need forensic evidence. They need his DNA.
And he couldn't really walk up to his front door and say, can you stick out your tongue and let me have a swab of your epithelial cells? So we found that his daughter, she had had a procedure where she left stored at the medical center her epithelial cells.
The cells are sent for DNA comparison. In the meantime, the investigation must remain a closely guarded secret. Investigators know BTK took trophies of his killings. If Rader really is BTK, and if he hears he's being investigated, he could destroy the evidence.
Everything was very, very quiet, very secret. All along, you know, they were watching him 24/7. The excitement was just palpable.
Then, Nola Fulston hears the news she had been waiting for. The DNA is a match.
And the match was that young girl was the daughter of BTK.
Wichita had lived under the shadow of the BTK killer for 30 years. Now, finally, investigators have the proof they need to act. On the 25th of February, 2005, Dennis Rader is arrested near his home in Park City. Amazingly, the whole thing is caught on police camera.
The bottom line, BTK is arrested.
It's the moment Steve Relford had waited for nearly 30 years.
I said, that's him. That's definitely him. Can't forget that face.
Police search Rader's home, his parents' house, and his office. They uncover a treasure trove of BTK's memorabilia.
He kept all these files. He kept files on everyone, every person he killed.
They also find photographs of the crime scenes and disturbing pictures that Rader had taken of himself.
He would take photographs of himself in women's clothing. And we had pictures of him swinging through the trees, ropes on his neck. He put himself in a grave. He would put a extension cord on a Polaroid camera and pull the flash.
Rader's dark obsession with death and bondage is a secret he had kept from everyone since childhood.
When he was a youngster, he first became sexually aroused watching his grandmother cut the head off a chicken.
By the time he was a freshman or sophomore in high school, he knew what he was and he knew what his life was going to be.
On March the 1st, 2005, Rader is charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder. He doesn't speak at his arraignment, so the judge enters pleas of not guilty. But on June the 27th, the first day of Rader's trial, he changes his plea to guilty.
enter a plea of guilty in this case. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
The judge asks Rader to provide details of his crimes. What follows is probably one of the most extraordinary displays ever by a murderer in court. A chilling account of each of his crimes, beginning with the brutal murders of four of the Otero family over 30 years earlier.
Did you know these people?
No, that was part of my, what you call fantasy. I came through the back door, had reservations about even going or just walking away, but pretty soon the door opened and I was in.
Rader describes how he confronted the family, telling them he just needed their car and some food. If they cooperated, he wouldn't harm them. He took them back to a bedroom, tied them up, and then one by one, he started to suffocate and strangle them.
First of all, Mr. Otero was strangled. Then I thought he was going down, and I went over and strangled Mrs. Otero.
That man talked so systematic, so like, it was like putting down a pack of dogs.
Mrs. Otero woke back up and, you know, she was pretty upset what's going on. So I came back and at that point in time, strangled her for a death strangle at that time.
It's like looking in the eyes of a shark, you know, and there's nothing there. This guy's almost lifeless.
In court, Rader explains that Joey and Josephine also came to again. He took Joey into another bedroom and suffocated him.
My little brother was my best friend. He's my best friend. This chokes me up. My best friend. He used to run with me and play tag. Everything, everything.
Then he took Josephine down to the basement.
I heard that at one point, he asked my sister when he was carrying her down the stairs, you know, half naked to hang her, if she knew whether it was a camera so he could take pictures of her.
The judge takes Rader through each of the 10 alleged murders, including that of Steve Relford's mother, Shirley Vian.
I told Ms. Vian that I had a problem with sexual fantasies, that I proceeded to tie her up. She got sick, threw up, got her a glass of water, comforted her a little bit, and then I went ahead and tied her up, and then put a bag over her head and strangled her.
Yeah, he had no remorse whatsoever. No remorse, no nothing.
Rader also tells the judge how he'd selected his victims.
Dennis Rader would drive his car down the street and he would look on the porches and see people walking down the street, and all of a sudden he would see a woman and he would say, "She's the one," and he would point at her. And from that point on, he would concentrate on her. Totally random, totally random. If he picked you out, you might be dead.
For Rader, the stalking and meticulous planning of his attacks was all part of the thrill. And as he talks about one of his victims, Marina Hedge, who was actually one of his neighbors, the court hears more about his bizarre double life.
He took his son to a Boy Scout camp. They were at Boy Scout camp all day, and then everybody bedded down. Well, he got up about midnight, left the camp, went out and killed a woman, came back, continued with the Boy Scout camp as if nothing had happened.
Rader had driven Marina Hedge's body to his church, where he'd photographed her corpse, naked and bound.
He could operate in two worlds, the world of the normal and the world of the bizarre, and never mix them up.
I will accept these pleas of guilty and adjudge you, Dennis L. Rader, guilty of murder in the first degree in count one, a class A felony.
On August the 17th, 2005, Dennis Rader is back in court for sentencing. There was no death penalty in Kansas at the time of the murders, so that's not an option. But in an unusual move, Prosecutor Nola Fulston presents shocking evidence of each murder. determined Reader will get the maximum possible sentence. It's an ordeal for the victims' families, but it's also an opportunity for them to have their say.
Shirley Byan was my mother. I'd just like for him to suffer for the rest of his life.
This man needs to be thrown in a deep, dark hole and left to rot. He should never, ever see the light of day.
Next, Dennis Rader rises to read a statement he's prepared.
Your Honor, Sedgwick County, the victims.
But for this man who craves attention and loves an audience, it won't go the way he'd expected.
Yeah, when he started talking, everybody got up and left. I was the first one, and then everybody followed me. We didn't want to hear what he had to say.
It was such a positive statement. We don't need to hear you. I wish I could have gone with him.
Dennis Rader is sentenced to 10 consecutive life terms, requiring a minimum of 175 years without chance for parole.
His cell is very, very small. None of the accoutrements that a normal citizen would have in their life. And I think that's really good. I wish him longevity.
Late one autumn night, reclusive architect Simon Dale is bludgeoned to death in his country house. Accused of his murder is his ex-wife, the Baroness de Stempel, Susan Wilberforce.
She was always threatening him that she was going to get someone to kill him.
The alleged motive involves Heath House, which Susan co-owns, but Simon still lives in.
Yes, I did want him out of house, it's quite true. But I didn't need to have to kill him for it.
The case illuminates dark secrets and a web of deceit. Can Susan's testimony clear her name? In the case of the murder in the mansion. Sixty-eight-year-old Simon Dale lives alone in the country mansion, Heath House. The eccentric old man is convinced the house is connected to the legend of King Arthur. Simon is nearly blind, but manages to get by without help and keeps to himself. Then, on September the 11th, 1987, he is murdered.
This man in his 60s, living in rather odd circumstances, but doing no one any harm, opened his door on a Friday night in the middle of Shropshire and was subjected to the most brutal, violent attack, whose design really can only have been to kill him or do him very, very serious injury.
Two days later, Simon's secretary phones Heath House. When he doesn't answer, she drives over to check on him and finds Simon's lifeless body on the kitchen floor. One of the first officers to arrive on the scene is forensic expert Jeffrey Daniels.
It was in the east wing kitchen porch that there was the first indication of violent activity. Inside the kitchen, the deceased was lying on his back, and there was blood around the head. Close examination revealed what appeared to be five wounds to the top of the head. And also there was a slight mark to the throat.
Simon Dale's head wounds had been made by a heavy, blunt instrument. But the police also noticed that the kitchen table has been moved.
The deceased had struck his throat whilst falling forward on the edge of the table. Resulted in a broken thyroid and hyoid bone, and so he would have choked on his own blood.
Simon Dale's death horrifies the local community.
We heard that he'd fought bitterly, this person who killed him, and I thought, fancy fighting a blind man to kill him. He must be pretty horrible.
At first, police are puzzled by the crime.
There was no ordinary, inverted commas, criminal motive. There was no theft, there was no burglary from within the house.
But it doesn't take long for the investigation to point directly at Simon's ex-wife. Susan Wilberforce has remarried and has gained the title of Baroness de Stempel.
There was only one motive. It was someone who hated him with such venom, they would go to that length. And the Baroness de Stempel was the only person of which there was evidence of someone really hating him at all.
The acrimony between Susan Wilberforce and Simon Dale revolved around Heath House, the Queen Anne mansion they had bought a couple of years after they married, with Susan's money. Susan is impeccably aristocratic. She is descended from Sir William Wilberforce, famous in Britain as the man who abolished slavery. But despite Susan's breeding, she has no real money. All of Susan's assets are tied up in Heath House. And 12 years after she divorced Simon, he still refused to move out.
The battlefield was Heath House. She appeared to become obsessed with getting it off him, getting it onto the market, and getting her half share of the value.
With Simon dead, the house is now solely owned by Susan. But did she kill him to get it? In the months leading up to Simon's murder, Susan is often on the grounds of Heath House. She is renovating the exterior because she wants to sell it. But Simon won't let her over the threshold and has even put locks on the windows.
One day when I went, she'd been there with some of her children on the higher windows with ladders and things, trying to get these locks undone. He was quite worried.
Simon is convinced Susan has managed to break in.
She and her children got in and took furniture, according to Simon. It really was, to all intents and purposes, been pretty well cleared.
Susan claims three quarters of the furniture was hers anyway. But it's alleged that some of Susan's other behaviour is more threatening.
We find Simon sometimes almost frightened, because he was blind, living alone, and he'd say, she's been here and she's going to have me killed and things. And we'd say, oh, nonsense, you can't do that in these days. Well, he said once to us, she said she can drop on two people in Leominster who would do it for 1,000. And I remember him saying that. And he was beginning to get a bit alarmed.
Susan is reported as being hostile to Simon's friends who visit the house. It's why she is so clearly remembered by two people who called to see him the night he died.
When they arrived on the Friday, there was some confrontation with the Baroness. So she was clearly there when they arrived.
Simon's visitors tell police that Susan Wilberforce was still on the property when they left at 8:30 p.m. Within 12 hours of the discovery of Simon Dale's body, police are at Susan Wilberforce's door.
The discovery of the body on the Sunday afternoon led to the police attending late at night on the Sunday, after midnight, to go and tell her and get some account from her. She was up, she was clothed, they banged on the door, she didn't answer immediately, and they told her relatively quickly that they'd come to announce that Simon had been found dead, and she never asked how, when, where, or why. Nil response, no questions. And she said to the police, has he burned the house down?
When he was attacked the previous Friday night, Simon had been cooking his dinner. By the time his body was found, the kitchen is boiling hot because the oven and hob have been on constantly for 2 days. Susan Wilberforce's behaviour makes police instantly suspicious of her. And during their search for the murder weapon, they uncover another link to the Baroness de Stempel.
On the back of a door in the cottage within the grounds of Heath House, a jemmy, which is also referred to as a case opener, was found, and there was some reference by a witness or witnesses that she would often carry this jemmy for the purposes of gardening.
The jemmy is a possible match to the wounds on Simon Dale's head. It's sent off to the forensics lab for testing.
After we'd done as much as we could, the cleaner was allowed to examine the premises, and she thought that one of the pokers may have been missing from the main hall.
The missing fire poker is another contender for the murder weapon. After an extensive search, police are amazed when it turns up in the back of Susan Wilberforce's car. Susan claims she borrowed the poker to clean her chimney. The mounting evidence against her does nothing to soften Susan's attitude.
Her conduct in interview by the police was strange in the extreme. She viewed them with disdain as people who were intruding into her affairs and her life and to whom she was hostile.
Police search Susan's house. To their frustration, they don't find anything that connects her to Simon Dale's murder. But they do find something highly suspicious.
One of the things they came across when her house was searched was a will made by Lady Illingworth.
Lady Illingworth was Susan Wilberforce's great aunt, known lovingly as Puss. She had helped raise Susan, introduced her to London high society, and was fabulously wealthy. Great Aunt Puss had moved out of her large London flat in 1984 and into Susan's small cottage.
The officer who was in charge of the murder investigation made further inquiries, found that Lady Illingworth, who had obviously at some time in her life been a very, very wealthy woman, had in fact died as a pauper in a council old people's home in Hereford. And he went to the local crematorium and he actually found that the cremation bill had not been paid.
At almost exactly the same time Lady Illingworth moved in with Susan, her fortune started to disappear. The murder team working the case of Simon Dale now calls in the fraud squad.
During the investigation, we came across numerous documents, in excess of 60, bearing Lady Illingworth's signature. Those documents were sent to the Forensic Science Laboratory, and all of them came back saying that they were forgeries.
Susan and two of her children by Simon Dale, 25-year-old Sophia and 26-year-old Marcus, are implicated in the fraud. Also accused is Susan's second husband, the Baron de Stempel. Each of them had received thousands of pounds deposited in newly opened bank accounts. And Sophia, who has been working as a nanny, has managed to buy a second house in Spain.
There were a number of sales of jewellery, furniture, of paintings. There were a number of bank accounts that had been opened and drained. Premium bonds had been cashed, saving certificates had been cashed. My estimate would be somewhere in the region of £1 million.
On December the 14th, 1987, the police charged Susan, Marcus, Sophia, and the Baron de Stempel with defrauding Great Aunt Puss. 4 weeks later, they charged Susan with the murder of Simon Dale. The children and the Baron are eventually released on bail, but Susan is remanded in custody for 18 months. On July the 18th, 1989, 55-year-old Susan Wilberforce, the Baroness de Stempel, arrives at court. She pleads not guilty to murdering Simon Dale. To make sure the jury are not prejudiced, they are not told about Susan's fraud charge. Even so, the prosecution believes they have enough evidence to convict her, although it's all circumstantial.
Circumstantial evidence can be the most damning of evidence. And many murders, I suspect the majority of murders, are not committed in front of eyewitnesses. So many murder trials will depend upon circumstantial evidence.
Everything hinges on Susan's ability to explain the damning circumstances when she takes the stand on day 9 of the trial.
She was cross-examined by Anthony Palmer, who was probably the best cross-examiner of his day, nationally, a quite outstanding barrister. And I think even he would say to you that she matched him.
Anthony Palmer launches into an aggressive cross-examination. He runs through all of the circumstantial evidence which the prosecution claims points to Susan.
At the top of the list, she was the only person who had an identifiable motive. And it was a powerful motive. It was a motive that was born of years of wrangling over this property to the point where it was all that really mattered to her.
But Susan Wilberforce denies having a motive. Her defence submits evidence that the courts were considering an application to eject Simon Dale from Heath House lawfully. She claims she had no reason to kill him.
Number two was the lack of any other sign of a crime. There was no theft, there was no burglary from within the house. He had money in his wallet, in his pocket.
Susan Wilberforce's defence team argues that just because nothing was stolen from the house does not prove Susan murdered Simon Dale.
Number three, she was present at the house on the night he was murdered, not long before he was murdered, behaving in the odd way, hostile to his guests, spying and lurking.
Susan does not dispute that she was at the house on the day Simon died. After all, she was often on the grounds and had every right to be there.
She knew exactly how to deal with what she was going to have to deal with. She was a very careful, able presenter of the account she wished to give, and she was not, in my view, daunted by the enormity of the situation she was in.
Even Susan's alibi exasperates the prosecution. She says she was at home watching Agatha Christie's Murder in the Vicarage on television the night Simon was killed. In response, her own barrister remarks that they could use a little help from Miss Marple in this case too. Next, the prosecution turns to the possible murder weapons. They claim there is very strong circumstantial evidence linking the jemmy to Susan.
There was a witness, Adrian Tyndall, and he had come over one day and seen the Baroness in the grounds holding a jemmy. And he'd asked her, why have you got that? And the answer was that she always carried it because she feared she would be attacked by Simon Dale.
Prosecutor Anthony Palmer presses the point, suggesting that rather than use the jemmy for defense, Susan had attacked Simon with it. Susan is reported as saying, you can suggest that until you're blue in the face. That is not true. The other possible murder weapon is the fire poker, retrieved from the back of Susan's car. It was examined by forensics, but it had been scrubbed clean. To the prosecution's frustration, there is no forensic link to Susan.
There was no evidence found on either the poker or the case opener to indicate that it was well and truly involved in causing the wounds to Simon Dale's head.
Only once does prosecutor Anthony Palmer appear to rattle Susan Wilberforce, when he suggests she was getting increasingly frustrated by her ex-husband.
She was in a bit of trouble on one point and snapped out an obscenity. The word she used was bollocks. I think she said, bollocks, Mr. Palmer. But she certainly said the first word.
But rather than fuel the impression that Mr. Palmer has her on the ropes, Susan's outburst breaks the tension. The public gallery almost cheered.
I have to say that I don't think she was ever rattled. She was as calm and controlled from beginning to end, at all stages.
On August the 1st, 1989, the jury retires to deliberate. It takes just under 4 hours to return a verdict that declares Susan Wilberforce not guilty of murdering Simon Dale. Two years later, in a typical act of defiance, Susan gives an interview in which she dismisses the entire basis of the case against her.
Well, they had to think up something, didn't they? Yes, I did want him out of house, it's quite true. But I didn't need to have to kill him for it, because the court was going to do it, and we were waiting for a date for it to be officially done. I don't think I had a motive at all.
Still, back in 1990, despite having just won her murder trial, she did not succeed in winning her freedom.
Well, after the Baroness had been acquitted of the murder, she was taken back to the remand centre from whence she'd come to wait to stand trial for the fraud.
Throughout the murder and fraud investigations, Susan has maintained her innocence. But 3 weeks before her fraud trial begins, she changes her plea to guilty.
I think she must have been advised by her legal advisers that the evidence was completely overwhelming.
In the same interview 2 years later, Susan is asked if she pleaded guilty because she knew the evidence was stacked against her.
I don't think so at all. I think it's a lot of nonsense.
Because you quite obviously forged her signature on a will, as well as many other documents.
Well, that is a result of plea bargaining when I was under very great pressure, and I just in a weak moment, gave in and agreed to plead guilty, but it doesn't mean to say I've done it. Just because you plead guilty, you know, it doesn't mean to say you've done it.
On the 19th of February 1990, Susan Wilberforce's children Marcus and Sophia arrive at court. Unlike their mother, they are pleading not guilty. They maintain they were unwitting accomplices in defrauding their elderly relative, Lady Illingworth. Susan's second husband, the Baron, also protests his innocence. He claims he was merely a porter for Lady Illingworth's belongings. After a 3-week trial, the jury finds them all guilty.
Marcus was sentenced first, and yes, he did collapse on the floor and had to be picked up and helped out of the court.
Marcus falls to the ground less than 2 metres from his mother.
Susan didn't respond to it at all. If she did flick her eyes down, I was actually in court at the time and watched her. She didn't move her head towards where Marcus had fallen. She just looked straight ahead of him.
Nor does Susan Wilberforce react when the remaining sentences are handed down.
The Baroness got 7 years. The Baron got 4 years. Sophia, 30 months. And Marcus, 18 months.
Susan Wilberforce never moved back into Heath House. The home she bought with Simon Dale when they were first married sold in 1993 for just over £250,000. But Susan didn't receive any of the money. It was swallowed by a long-running legal battle instigated by Lady Illingworth's estate to try to reclaim the old lady's fortune, which Susan stole. No one has ever been convicted of the murder of Simon Dale. The case remains open today.